Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As I continue to look for more ways to fulfill my pledge to provide the information you need to make informed choices about your health and wellness, I've developed a simple way for you to access curated supplement protocols previously available only to patients in my private practice. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com. There you'll find easy-to-follow links to not only the best individual products, but also to my brand new Intelligent Medicine Lifestyle Supplement Protocols that combine the products I recommend to achieve your specific goals, whether it be heart health, immune support, and much more. It's the easiest way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need in order to follow the Intelligent Medicine Lifestyle. And for a limited time, you'll also receive free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our subject, gastrointestinal problems, the GI tract. Well, there's a lot of things that can go wrong with it. You can have GERD, you can have IBS, you can have colitis. It's also the body's main detoxification organ, that is the subject of a very, very detailed monograph, 250 pages long, Functional Strategies for the Management of Gastrointestinal Disorders by today's guest, Dr. Thomas Gwilliams. Dr. Gwilliams works with Orthomolecular, which is a company that makes very fine nutritional supplements. He's vice president for product development. Let me get the correct title.
Science.
Okay. And which involves, you know, researching, plausible, ingredients and formulations that health practitioners use. And these are products that I rely on quite heavily. And I'm in debt to you for your scrupulous attention to the science because, you know, we want to use, we want to use science-based products. We don't want to just use stuff that, well, you know, folklore says it's beneficial and, you know, maybe, it's some sort of exotic formula that, you know, nobody's really questioned. And you know, that's something that, you know, that's your professional mandate to look into this. Okay, so in part one, you know, we kind of laid the groundwork for our discussion. Let's focus on really a common, well, you know, I dislike the term, and probably you do too, irritable bowel syndrome, kind of a wastebasket term. You know, we can't really find, very, very profound inflammation. So you don't have colitis. Basically nothing's wrong except, you got a lot of complaints. What's up with that?
So irritable bowel syndrome, IBS, is a quintessential, quote, functional bowel disorder. In fact, we don't have time to get into this, but, you know, this actually, the idea of IBS, or what became known as IBS was sort of the spawn of what became the Rome Group, the Rome Foundation, which was a group of clinicians that would get together, highly sponsored by pharmaceutical companies to help define what these sort of functional bowel disorders. And when we say functional, it means we can't find any what they call organic, something organic problem. We can't define, you know, an infection. We can't say there's a broken, you know, a part. So it's functional. It's just based on the symptoms that we see. And out of Rome, in fact, Rome, the group has met once, twice, and now they published what's called Rome 4 criteria just a few months ago, actually, after 10 years. They've got, I think, 40-some-odd disorders now, including IBS, which is their sort of their flagship disorder, and four versions of that, you know, the diarrhea, the constipation, the mixed between diarrhea and constipation, and the undefined, which means we can't tell what it's going to be. And so the problem, like you mentioned, it's based on a series of criteria based on pain, which is actually a requirement for the condition, but something to do with, related to the bowel movements and whether they're, you know, whether it's diarrhea or whether it's constipation. And so it's very difficult to get a hold of. And like you mentioned, one of the things that you have to do is rule out everything else. So you have to rule out inflammatory bowel disease. You have to rule out celiac disease. You have to rule out you know, other types of diarrhea or constipation kind of things, opioids and whatever. And then finally, when you've got all of those ruled out and the patient still has pain and it's related to their bowel movements, then basically we give it the title IBS or irritable bowel syndrome. And so, as you know, as a clinician, that can be very frustrating, because in the end, what you really want to know is not what to call it, but what to do about it. Yep. And that's why sort of understanding and asking questions about, well, maybe we're learning now, maybe there's a microbiome when there's the bacteria are in a imbalance, or maybe there's a permeability issue that needs to be dealt with, and or maybe inflammation or these other things that we can look at. And that's why it's really important to look at these functions rather than merely looking at how you name the disease.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the claim has been made is that it, to some extent it's a psychological disorder. People have a heightened sensitivity to pain. Maybe they're, you know, it's highly correlated with depression. Is that really the case, or is it an organic disease where there really are some demonstrable irregularities?
Well, I think, you know, we're learning more and more now, I guess, even in the last few years, about IBS generally, because like I said, it's a collection of all these different syndromes, and the question is, are they really all the same thing? And I think we're learning probably they're not. In many cases, we are seeing a high frequency of stress-related or psychological-related disorders, and there seems to be, obviously, there's a strong connection between the gut and the brain and the signals that go back and forth. And we're learning that, you know, the stress signals actually, not only do they manifest in the brain and then go to what we call the adrenal gland and all the things that we've talked about in the past, but there's actually ways that those can signal motility, changes in inflammation, and even intestinal permeability, believe it or not, when you have the stress signals there. So it appears that, you know, whether we want to call that an organic connection or not, there certainly is a major connection there. As it turns out, one of the things that we've known about for a long time is what's called post-infection IBS, where, mm-hmm. where people have sort of IBS symptoms after an infection. And oftentimes it's like a foodborne illness or traveling diarrhea or something like that.
They were sick and they're never right after that. They just never seem to resolve. It's like something that persists or echoes or maybe activates their nerves or creates a chronic inflammation. Something's going on.
Right. Exactly, and now there actually is believe it or not, in the diarrhea form. So this is what we call IBS/D, the diarrhea form of IBS. There actually is a new test that is very good at confirming this, and this is actually a test that looks for a toxin that's sort of left behind by a food poisoning. And a cross reaction, a cross reaction, autoimmune type cross reaction to a protein in the cells, that is caused by this immune response to this toxin. And so clinicians can start looking at this and saying, okay, you know, you may have a post-infectious change in the immune system and in the motility system that causes this IBS, this diarrhea. Unfortunately, we don't really have a way to solve it, so we can diagnose it. We can say, okay, I think you might have IBS-D or you might have this post-infectious syndrome, but we really don't know what to do about it because it seems like it may be actually a damage to the nerves mm-hmm. within the GI tract, which we can't yet know how to repair.
Right. So often conventional gastroenterologists will give basically tranquilizing agents, sometimes antidepressants, but sometimes agents that specifically slow down the GI tract or reduce the pain threshold or the fullness threshold of the gastrointestinal tract to sort of calm things down, but without maybe addressing underlying issues like a disrupted microbiome or a food intolerance or something like that.
Right. So I think you're very right. I think the idea though behind that is we do have a lot of other ways of sending signals, using the microbiome, using other sorts of things so that we don't exacerbate what's already going on there. And I think there's probably, while we may not be able to solve directly the nerve damage, I think probably these other factors could make up the difference.
Indeed. So now has emerged a very popular concept called SIBO. Now, when we used to talk about dysbiosis, which is kind of similar. We can distinguish between the two if you like. A disruption of bacteria in the intestinal tract. You know, we didn't get much attention, but now with the advent of a popular drug that happens to be very expensive, by the way, it's called Xifaxan. You now have a lot of gastroenterologists signing on to the concept of SIBO. So what is that, and, you know, how might we treat it?
So SIBO, S-I-B-O, stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And the idea is that, you know, the small intestines are supposed to have a lot fewer bacteria growing than, let's say, in the large intestine. And so when we see an overgrowth of these in the small intestine, it creates a number of different problems. The main one being that most of our digestion hasn't occurred yet, and so a lot of the components of our food, which are supposed to wait until they get down to the large intestine before they start fermenting and creating all this gas, all of a sudden can start being fermented in the small intestines because there's more bacteria there. And so that creates a lot of upper GI gas and bloating and pain and distension and all kinds of things that we can measure and we can look at. And so, like you mentioned, Xifaxan, or that's the trade name, Rifaximin. That basically is a drug that basically it's an antibiotic, and it's an antibiotic that supposedly doesn't absorb into the body and is supposed to then, kill off these bacteria and, you know, away we go. The problem is there's a couple different issues. One is there does appear to be this special kind of dysbiosis where the bacteria either come from the large intestine and come up, probably more to do with the fact that we're not eliminating properly and a lot of this happens in slow bowel transit time. Mm-hmm. Or there's something else going on with the immune system, or maybe low stomach acid, so these bacteria are kind of creeping their way up closer and closer to the stomach because of that. So there's lots of basic things that we can do. One of the things that when you really look into the literature and ask the question about SIBO is, do you really have it? And so how do you know? Well, you know, the classic way is to aspirate, take a tube and actually get into the small intestine, take a little bit of the fluid, and then plate it out and find out exactly how many bacteria are there. Well, not too many people volunteering for aspirating their duodenum. So what we typically do is we give them, in this case, lactulose, which we already mentioned. We give this a carbohydrate and to see at what time that begins to ferment. And the way that you know that is you take a breath test, and as the fermentation of lactulose occurs in the stomach, in the small intestines and the large intestines, it gives off a gas, which then can be measured in someone's breath. And so it's this kind of delicate, you know, you take these certain every 10 minutes, or depending on how the lab does it, you breathe into a balloon or into a bag, and those are sent to a lab, and they can test the hydrogen and other gases in there, and they can tell you, sure enough, you've been fermenting earlier than you should have, and therefore that we predict that you have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. However, unfortunately, some people that have very quick transit time, the fermentation is actually in the colon and not in the small intestines. So it's a little bit hard to gauge whether this is an accurate test. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we need to really, the unfortunate other thing is if patients don't follow the lab, the instructions very, very carefully of what not to eat and how to do it, it's very easy to misinterpret. So mm-hmm. it is a good non-invasive test, but it may be misinterpreted. Nonetheless, we are seeing more and more people diagnosing this idea of SIBO, and more people obviously giving Rifaximin because of that. And the question is, you know, down the road a couple of years, we're going to find out if this was really a good idea or not. I think the jury is still out on whether this is a good way of treating this phenomena. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, typically conventional medicine likes the approach of find a bug, use a drug. And so, you know, now that this concept is popularized because it juices sales of a popular medication, Xifaxan. But what about natural therapy for SIBO or for, you know, let's suppose someone has gas, bloating, urgency that may be attributed to that? Are there better ways of handling it than just taking an antibiotic?
So I think you know, looking at what's going on in the patient, really, it's really, I think, for the clinician, it really is a diagnostic challenge. You know, what is going on? Why would this patient be having this issue? Are there foods in their diet? Are they not digesting? One of the issues, obviously, would be low stomach acid. First thing you want to look at is low stomach acid, low pancreatic enzymes for digestion, because the symptoms of SIBO are really the fermentation of the food that the person's eating. Mm-hmm. And so we need to make sure
so
that's
the
going
food is,
on.
The food is not broken down properly. It becomes like a real medium for the bacteria to feast on.
Right. And one of the dietary restrictions that has proven to be helpful in a lot of these individuals is what's called a low FODMAP diet. And I don't know if you've mm-hmm. spoken of this in any sure. of your lectures, but that low FODMAP. So it's basically removing from the diet, they're all carbohydrates that basically help that cause fermentation. The FODMAP stands for fructose, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. Those are just fancy names for a bunch of sugars that can be fermented. So there is this low FODMAP diet, which has been very helpful in people with SIBO, also very helpful in people with IBS, because of the relationship between the two are very similar, and that you see a lot of overlap with people that are diagnosed with IBS that also can be diagnosed with SIBO. And so that kind of diet, some people do better with fibers, so you give them a fiber and it really benefits because it helps move things along, but then certain fibers then can create fermentation. So people need to experiment if they have SIBO with different sorts of fibers, different sorts of carbohydrates in their diet. They might want to consider going online, looking up the FODMAP, the reduced mm-hmm. FODMAP diet, at least for a time, to see if that would help. I think that's really important. And then, you know, nutritional deficiencies are another one that people need to look at. I think multivitamin kind of for those people. And then, of course, I think there's not overwhelming evidence, but I think there's good evidence that probiotics are likely to be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. You know, before SIBO, before FODMAP, before all of this, back in the 80s, the concept emerged of Candida. And you actually, you know, refer to this as, you know, there may be something going on in some people that's not bacterial overgrowth. It's fungal overgrowth, maybe accompanied by bacterial overgrowth. Like, two can coexist. But speak to that issue and, you know, what are some of the ways to address that?
Yeah, so if you go back to the 80s and 90s, that was obviously a very, what we might call an alternative medicine diagnosis, was that there was overgrowth of Candida in the GI tract. And of course, Candida, which are yeast, and they're everywhere. I mean, they're part of what we call commensal organisms. They're part of the human existence, not only in the GI tract, but really almost everywhere on our body. The issue is, it grows too much. Now, if it grows in the mouth, we have thrush. You know, a lot of women have yeast infections. Most of those are Candida related. But when it comes to just sort of when we don't see it in those obvious places, it's hard to understand that perhaps it's overgrowing in the GI tract. And what we typically see is, because they're yeast, you know, they ferment and they actually make certain alcohols, they make other metabolites, which then can get into the bloodstream and create sort of these other non-GI related symptoms that people experience. And for a long time, people were, you know, kind of mainstream medicine would kind of poo-poo the idea of, you know, Candida overgrowth and the symptoms that were related with that, like mental fog and joint pain and kind of fatigue and malaise and all these kinds of other things. And now we've learned that, sure enough, that overgrowth of Candida in the GI tract can produce metabolites that can be felt in other areas of the body and create sort of these other non-GI related symptoms that aren't as well, you know, easily to diagnose as thrush or a yeast infection. So I document here not only the relationship between that and, of course, the use of diets that restrict sugar and the benefits of those in reducing the Candida growth, and then specific plants, mostly botanicals that are antifungal that can be used to help reduce the burden. Obviously, we can't get rid of candida, and maybe that's not even our goal to get rid of candida, but certainly to reduce it to the point where it's not an overgrowth. And the other big component of that is we know that candida overgrowth is very common in people with poor immune systems, and classically in HIV patients and other things like that, or where we have immune suppressant, people using corticosteroids. But anytime candida is elevated, clinicians and people should always be thinking about, you know, something is diminished in the immune system, and we always want to support the immune system, then we want to think about that as well.
Indeed. And finally, perhaps you could touch upon one of my favorite topics, which is inflammatory bowel disease. We see a lot of patients at the Hoffman Center with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And it's been said until recently by many gastroenterologists that it's not about diet, that the only way to go is through some of the powerful new medications that are used. But there are adjunctive strategies, dietary strategies and nutraceutical strategies, probiotic strategies that may help. You turned up quite a lot of them in your new publication.
So inflammatory bowel disease, the benefit here, you know, writing a book like this and kind of getting into all these topics, inflammatory bowel disease was obviously a topic where there's lots of research. So this is an area where there's obviously enough people suffering from a disease like this that there's lots of money being poured into looking at things, not only from the drug side, which obviously there is, and the area of drugs now with biologics, some of these, the price of some of these anti-TNF antibody is just outrageously high. And that's really where a lot of the research is going. But when we step back and we say, okay, what is really going on here, inflammatory bowel disease, we're starting to learn that it's a very specific connection, and it's really an auto-inflammatory or autoimmune connection between the body's immune system and the bacteria living in the gut. And we're learning more and more now that relationship and that interaction is the key to understanding inflammatory bowel disease. Now, obviously, the two different ones, Crohn's disease versus colitis, they're different in how they manifest, and they actually are very different in how they can be treated. And that's true of both the drugs and of the natural supplements. For instance, there's lots and lots of data to say that probiotics are very helpful for helping people with ulcerative colitis. But if you look at the data on Crohn's disease, there's a lot less positive studies. In fact, very few studies that show probiotics to be helpful. Mm-hmm. And that's true of a couple other things that we've discovered. And it's probably has to do with the fact that, and I don't want to get too technical here, but Crohn's disease is sort of patchy. It's all along both the small and large intestines, probably very close to the immune system, kind of communities. And where ulcerative colitis is kind of all collected down together at the end of the colon. And it's possible because of the concentration of the problem that you see with UC that it's actually easier to treat because you can get more concentrated, effective treatments in one area rather than a little bit here, a little bit there, all the way through the GI tract. So I mentioned, and I actually catalog quite a bit of evidence on vitamin D therapy for individuals with both conditions. Vitamin D can be very helpful as a preventative and as a therapeutic agent. And of course, everyone with IBD should be tested for vitamin D levels because it's likely to be low. And so I enumerate that. I also enumerate several of the botanicals that we mentioned earlier as far as anti-inflammatory as well. So, this is an area, I think, inflammatory bowel disease especially is an area where we have lots of evidence that dietary changes and supplement use can be very helpful in reducing the symptoms of IBD.
Well, you've given us at least the flavor of this very detailed 250-page book that you've written on the subject of functional strategies for management of gastrointestinal disorders. That's what it's called. This is not unfortunately, for lay people. It's kind of technical, but there are health practitioners who subscribe to Intelligent Medicine Podcast and listen. How might they access this so that they can help their patients?
So there's two ways they can get it. They can get it online directly from the Point Institute, They can go and go to thepointinstitute.org or .net online and order it. Or they can, if they happen to be a healthcare professional, healthcare professionals can get both sources, but anybody can get it from the Point Institute. But healthcare professionals specifically that want to interact with orthomolecular products, they have designed something called the Lifestyle Matrix Resource Center. Lifestyle Matrix Resource Center. And they can go online and order the product, or order the books, I should say, directly from that organization. And I'll give you that website. It's called thelifestylematrix.com.
The
two options are,
right,
thelifestylematrix.com or pointinstitute.org.
Great.
Both of those would be available, and they can get them directly online from either one of those organizations.
Well, I want to congratulate you, Dr. Williams, on yet another fantastic project. You really have delved into this, taken a deep dive into gastrointestinal disorders and the role of the gastrointestinal system in overall health. And you are you're really a national treasure. You're an asset to the natural community because we need researchers like you who do the due diligence to look into some of the strategies that sometimes we take for granted.
Well, I appreciate you letting me come on and talk about it. And like I said earlier, I think I told you before we went on the air, it's at press right now. So we just got done with it. And I think you have a rogue copy on your desk that was sent to you, but it hasn't been printed and bound yet. So, but you can order it, and we're going to ship it out in the next 2 weeks. When it comes hot off the presses, they're going to be leaving. So there's like a pre-order price available on the website. So they'll want to get a copy if they can.
Yeah, that's one of the fringe benefits of doing this broadcast is I get all these great books, and this will be definitely on my shelf as I research solutions for some of the challenging patients I see at the Hoffman Center. Thanks so much, Dr. Williams, for joining us.
It was great to be with you.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.